Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. Mike, what do you mean you can't see me for the Kleenex box? We're on radio, not television. Okay, hold on. More about that later. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash, as we do every week, for taking us on that marvelous trip across the United States, 90 different cities and states, and one of these nights, I don't think we've ever done it, we should play the whole song so people could get a chance to hear the Man in Black do that number. Emily, thank you, and Mike, for being with us tonight, and you've got some special news items we'll work with a little bit later, and some good things, a lot of things going on in criminal justice news. Ohio's sort of busted a record here that something's never happened relative to an execution, and we'll be talking about during the news segment of the show. Our purpose is what it always is. We're trying to discuss events, issues, news, and developments in the field of criminal justice. And sometimes it's funny, isn't it? Yes, I think so. Our show is dedicated to those tireless and energetic courts, corrections, police, and juvenile justice professionals who serve us throughout the United States and the world. What we try to do in this show is look inside the criminal justice practice and take a close-up look at its professional. And tonight would be a real good example of that, because we're going to be doing our oral history part two show, and we're going to be looking at the career of Major Lyle Zupinka with the Pennsylvania State Police, and he was the object of an oral history interview, a good oral history interview, and it tells you a little bit about his career. And he was working as an area commander when the plane went down on 9/11, when the plane went down in Pennsylvania. So he'll have quite a bit to say about that. But his record shows that he got promoted about as fast as you could make it through the ranks of the Pennsylvania State Police. So that's interesting in and of itself. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and again, it's a magic system almost. It's a leading edge technology, and the Chief Executive Officer is Alan Levy. You can see him on television shows now talking about this. And BTR, Blog Talk Radio, is now one of the top 100 websites in the world, and everybody's had a show on there one time or another. The President of the United States has discovered BTR, and he's broadcast on there. So the thing is off and running. And to think about 3 years ago, just about this time, 3 years ago, Alan Levy started this with a little show on the network, one show where he got up and talked. Excuse me. He talked with members of his family concerning a passing in their family, and that started the whole thing. He was a telecom engineer and knew what to do with this this technology, and it certainly took off. So what happens here on this system, Blog Talk Radio Network, it's possible for any person who wants to, any interest group, any organization, they can have their own show, and they can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. Would somebody turn over in their grave in 1980 if they heard that? Because you can broadcast on a radio show worldwide, and millions can listen to you. And that would cost you absolutely nothing. So you'll go on that website. You'll see shows and everything imaginable. There are, oh, I forgot how many shows there are now. How many, Mike? 30,000 plus, something like that, on every subject imaginable. And one of my most favorite shows is The Laugh Lady, where they have laughter yoga. That one, it's hard not to smile when you listen to that that particular show. These shows are archived immediately and used for replay. You can download them. It's not something that just I can download. You can download these shows, and some of the criminal justice faculty around the state and the nation have taken a couple of our shows, more than a couple, and used them for classroom resources, that type of thing. So get your own show is what I say. It costs absolutely nothing. And you don't have to use it. You know, you can just sort of have it in storage, and you want to use it once a month, once a week, once a year, I suppose, it would still be reserved there for you. So tonight we're going to look at the Pennsylvania State Police, Part 2. One of the things we're trying to demonstrate here, since we're starting this little Ohio Criminal Justice Oral History Association, is something about the method. And you'll see the method here. I think it was a fine thing that the Pennsylvania State Police decided that they wanted to capture the record of these men and women who had retired from the Pennsylvania State Police and wanted to hear their stories before, you know, eventually we all pass, before they passed away. And that's what they've done. If you go to the site, just Google Pennsylvania State Police Oral History, it'll take you there. You'll not only have a chance to hear oral interviews in segments of one, two, or three per interviewee, per man or woman, but you can also see video for most of them. So oral history can also be done with a video. It's no different. You get them to talk the same way, and you turn on a camera and you watch them. So very interesting method and technique, and people usually love it to get involved in that type of thing. Anybody's listening tonight that wants to get involved in criminal justice oral history for criminal justice practitioners in the state of Ohio at any level, police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice, please join us. We've got a few people lined up already in our little group who are willing to be oral history interviewees. And I should mention that people love for this to happen because it's a record of their life that they can pass on to their kids. Some of these people may want to transcribe it and put part of it at least in a book or something like that. So it's a fine thing to do. Audrey, I think you have a bond book tonight. And can I say, is trepidated a word? I know trepidation is. But Audrey's a little trepidated tonight about this joke because, well, it has to do with, well, she'll tell you here in a second. Well, Audrey, go ahead. Go ahead with that joke.
Professor Haley, I hope no one will take offense at this blonde joke tonight since it involves death, but it's a funny one too. Here it is. There was a burning building with a redhead, a brunette, and a blonde at the top. The firemen are yelling to the redhead to jump into a blanket, and she jumps off the building, and right as she was about to safely hit the blanket, they moved it and she dies. They yell to the brunette to jump, but she says, comma quote, no, I saw what you did to the redhead. They shout, we don't like redheads. So the brunette jumps, and sure enough, they move the blanket and she dies. Then they shout to the blonde to jump off into the blanket. But the blonde says, no, I saw what you did to them. They shout, we don't like them. The blonde then says, I don't trust you guys. Put the blanket on the ground and step back.
Oh, Okay, so her she didn't trust the fireman to keep the blanket there, so step back and just let me jump straight on the blanket. That's a good one. Audrey, can we release this information now, at least a little squiggle of information about this? Audrey will be coming out with an Audrey Bond joke book. I don't know how quickly. Do you, Audrey? How soon is that going to happen? In probably 2 months, but it will be available. Audrey's Blonde Jokes from our show. Won't that be fantastic? And you can play those for your friends. You can play them in classes. You can play them to yourself. Or you can listen once and never play them. No, Audrey, I didn't mean that. Play them again. But that's going to be fantastic. We're very proud of you, Audrey, to do the work on those particular jokes. And ladies and gentlemen, on a more serious note, although one of our news items tonight is about how violent crime is down, we should never let our guard down. So the High Coalition Against Firearms has a message for the gang-banging street gang member criminals, and they want them to lay down their arms. Here's the message. High Coalition, go ahead.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. That is a very good point. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave this open tonight for the green tip. I bet you can't imagine what the green tip would be tonight. We're going to hold off on it just a little bit and see if anybody could guess it. No one here at the desk knows it. And it's a very sensible green tip. And I think it's just a natural progression in terms of where we're going to save energy and reduce our CO2 footprints on the earth or in the sky or wherever they're going. And I'm still looking for the person that's keeping the big calculator in the sky that tells us if you do that, that happens and that type of thing. I did read an article today that said that out of, I think, more than 200 universities that claim to join this Go Green business, only 60 some of them had filed their reports. They'd actually done what they were supposed to do so far. So the others are just trying to figure out, what to do. So let's go ahead and take a look at some of the news tonight. I think one of the interesting ones to start off with is we all love Homeland Security, and one of the things that's happened with the Department of Homeland Security is they've released a lot of funds. You know, you've heard me say, and you know yourself, that one of the things they do is they release funds to various places around the United States for surveillance cameras. And, you know, some of these surveillance camera systems that are up into the hundreds and even thousands, a good portion of that money has come from Homeland Security in order that, they search and detect terrorism cells and people and that type of thing. And hold on a second. I'm going to open the desk drawer. No terrorists there. But you never know. But anyway, Director Napolitano, I'm starting to feel sorry for her. This is a news story yesterday. She's facing criticism for her handling of the federal stimulus money. Homeland Security got some stimulus money, and she would not start any new border construction projects while the department reviewed how the projects were being selected now. What they come to find out is that some of this Homeland Security funds or stimulus money, you'd think it would go to the most needy, high-priority project, which they won't release. They figured out what these higher-priority projects are, but they're not willing to release that to the public. So it comes to find out, or they come to find out, that one of these projects, for example, went to a very small... There's no common sense at all to a requirement that says you got to put up a $15 million facility for a small port that's a host to about 5 vehicles an hour. And they give an example here of a little place up in Montana that has just a few cars go across the border in a matter of an hour. And they get a whole bunch of money. And some of these other places that, could you imagine that they might be communities where they're Republican-dominated in terms of political office holders? I knew you wouldn't say that, but two Montana Democratic senators, for instance, said they personally appealed to Napolitano to get money for the lower priority border projects. That included $15 million plan for Whitetail. which will build a checkpoint the size and cost, what does it say, of a hotel mansion at a crossing that serves three travelers a day. Can you believe this? Three travelers a day go across this, and they're going to build the equivalent of a luxury hotel there and spend $15 million doing it. So raise your hand. You're a part of that. Maybe they'll put your name out front on the building, whoever's listening tonight. She defended these decisions, though, she says in her letter, saying that northern border stations could be repaired for a fraction of what it would cost to fix the busier checkpoints. I think I get that logic, but I'm not exactly sure. So all the projects are on hold for a week, she said, until they review this business, and they'll take off from there, I suspect, hoping we forget all that from here. By the way, speaking of government involvement in maybe your life and personal life, the White House is collecting and storing comments and videos placed on its social work networking sites, such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. You know, White House is involved in all those, without notifying or asking the consent of the users. Failure that appears to run counter to President Obama's promise of a transparent government and his pledge to protect privacy. Now, they actually come back and say, look, this is, let me mention Mark Rotenberg. He's a very fine man. He's president of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He said the White House signaled that it insisted on open dealings with Internet users and, in fact, should feel obliged to disclose that it is collecting such information, but it doesn't. And he says if this is the transparent White House that we were promised, it's not going to happen. Folks come back and say that the Presidential Records Act, this comes from the White House, requires that the administration gather information and that it was justified in taking these additional steps of asking a private contractor to crawl and archive all such materials. Nicholas Sharp, a White House spokesman, declined to say when the practice began or how much the new contract would cost. So somebody got a lot of money for people to fall in on White House, Facebook, Twitter, whatever kinds of things. Interesting how that money gets passed around, isn't it? Doesn't make any difference who's in office. The article goes on and on and on, but rather interesting. Now, speaking of cameras, there's a Malapin, Florida, that little wealthy community with I think it's less than 2,500 residents. It's the one that has the car tracking technology in its city. In other words, you can't get in and out of the city without your car being video monitored and then a record made of your license plate, and that it's run immediately through a database to see if you're wanted for anything. Well, the same thing is happening in Medina, Washington. City signs have a unique way of greeting people. You've seen the ones that say speed zone ahead. Well, in this one, for instance, motorists are told that they're entering a special place where people care. For years, people invited others to say for a day or for a lifetime. In Medina, the new sign bears this: you're entering a 24-hour surveillance area. And they're not kidding. So for 24 hours a day, they're literally videotaping every car, digitally recording every car that comes in and out of the city. Now, why would you do this? I'll bet raise a finger at least, because I'm suspecting a very small portion of this funding for these cameras came from Homeland Security, which means it comes from federal taxes, and federal taxes come from you. Anyway, under the automatic license plate recognition system, once a car enters Medina, a camera captures its license number within seconds of the number sent through a database. If it comes up a hit for a felony, the vehicle was reported stolen or being driven by a homicide suspect, yes, the information is transmitted instantaneously to police, who can leap into action, says Police Chief Jeffrey Chen. These cameras provide us with intelligence. It gets us up front with the criminals. I don't like to be on a level playing field with criminals. He declined to give the number and location of the cameras. That's interesting. Medina, by the way, is a city of 3,100 people with an average household income of $222,000. 3,100 people, average income $222,000 a year. They had discussed this idea for years as a way to discourage crime. Last year in Medina, there were 11 burglaries total in this whole city of 31 people, and now they've got a camera system that they say is going to guarantee, since the cameras are going up, they've not had a burglary. And the information is stored for 60 days, and if nothing turns up, that allows police to mine data if a crime occurs later on. Doug Honig, he's with the American Civil Liberties Unit of Washington, said that such a system smacks of privacy violations. You know, you got that issue with some people say, well, you don't have any privacy in public. I think that's going to change, and we're going to get court decisions because we do private things in public. But actions like this, we're moving closer and closer to a surveillance society. Mr. Honig, where have you been? One of the council members, Lucius Bigelow, said crime prevention outweighs any concerns over privacy. That's what Ceausescu said in Romania, that security and outweighs privacy type of concerns. And he was a brutal dictator for more than 20 years in that nation. Privacy is considerably less nowadays than it was 50 years ago, the councilman says. I think most of us are pretty well documented by the federal government simply because of the internet and credit cards. Yeah, probably documented in some ways we can't even think of. He said, there's no secret. He said, we tell you, our cameras are everywhere. They're in stores, streets, parks, or whatever. He's talking in general about that. So it's interesting to see what will happen in little communities like that. But, you know, one of the things that's happened in Great Britain is, you know, has more cameras per capita than any place on the planet. They have come to find out that, guess who likes these cameras? It's pretty well shown that other than the one incident they've had with the train bombers, that they've not found any terrorists. It hasn't reduced crime to any significant degree. But what it has done, it has made the new immigrants and minority people in England stay away from public places. And guess what? A lot of the folks on the you know, the right side of society over there think that's a great idea. Let's keep running those cameras. And that's, you know, that's really counter to the whole idea of British, you know, British life, which is free, open, you know, one-time anonymous. People forget that anonymous part. That's why we don't have to carry around papers in the United States to identify ourselves, although the Patriot Act in some states have sort of slipped that in on us that, in fact, we might have to do that before a police. With the United Nations of all places, they've discovered that there are 750,000 pedophiles prowling on the internet. I thought it was 752,000. How in the world would we know? But apparently they've done some type of study, and they found this out, and they're really worried about it. He said more than 200 new images are also circulated daily. I would think it's more than that. And many of these pictures are exploited children. They're not only going up and growing in number, but also increasingly shocking in terms of these photos. He estimates between 10,000 and 100,000 minors are victims of the child pornography network. That's incredible, isn't it? But, you know, policing that takes a lot of staffing, takes a lot of work, smart deployment of police resources. So we hope that something is done about that. I'm not as adverse to the United Nations as some people would think I am. In fact, I know people who work there. But here's one that's really good. Mayor Bloomberg, he always comes up with the greatest ideas. You know that he was the mayor. I didn't realize this until I read this New York Times article. But Mayor Bloomberg, isn't he running for his, Mike, he's running for his third term, right? Unprecedented third term for mayor, I think. But anyway, he has proposed that you not be allowed to smoke in public parks. Even many smokers feel guilty about smoking these days. Walk through the city park or a city hall park or something, that's enjoyment to them. And it doesn't, they've got really no complaints. You don't hear people running down and complaining about, you know, some guy was sitting on a park bench smoking a cigarette. But Mayor Bloomberg says that he wants to ban smoking in public parks. And he was the guy that actually banned smoking first, at least a large community, banned smoking first in bars and restaurants. And it caught on like all over the world. And now he thinks that the next step is to go to the parks. Banning smoking in bars, restaurants, and workplaces is one thing, some of the people said, but banning cigarettes in parks is something else. You know, like, what's next? He said, this is like the nanny state, on the road to the nanny state. He also should take a look at some of the surveillance cameras that are watching him, too. One of these guys says it's a real quandary. He's a non-smoker. He was reading the paper during the break teaching English as an adjunct professor at Pace University. He says, this is a public space. What if somebody's eating a food that the odor is offensive to them? You know, we actually have ordinances around that in the United States. A few communities, if your home puts out offensive odors, you can be charged for that. I guess one man's odor is another man's, good scent. I don't know what they mean there, but exactly by that. But anyway, what they're thinking about, we're going to send people to jail because they smoked in a park. Wonder what people think about that in general. When I was smoking, he says they got rid of smoking in bars, and I thought that was great. But parks, the coworker says that's a little incredulous that they're going to be doing something like that. But Mayor Bloomberg's thought about that for a long time, and we'll see what happens. Well, you heard about our attempt at executing somebody this week. Governor Ted Strickland ordered a week-long reprieve for a condemned inmate after the execution team had problems finding his veins during the lethal injection process. These executioners, they struggled for more than 2 hours to locate suitable veins, inserting IVs into Rommel Broom, age 53, who was sentenced to die for the rape and slaying of Trina Middleton, age 14, in 1984. Can you believe that? He's been on death row since I assume he was convicted 84, 85, but he's been on death row that long. And it says that no governor has issued a similar last-minute reprieve since the state resumed executions in 1999. Most people don't realize this, but Ohio was real late in getting started. And we have been kind of busy per capita, actually. We've had some years like 6 and 7 and something like that where we've been second in the total, but nobody tops Texas, and executions stopped between 72 and 77. 76, but 77 was the first one. And Texas didn't get started until 1982, but didn't take them long to catch up. I think he would have already gone. So what this makes you think of is, what's the proper means to execute someone? The United States right now, we have lethal injection, which is by far the most popular method. We have hanging. We have firing squad, and some states still have the electric chair, I think, is sort of a backup rule or law. I have to check that. I haven't looked for a long time. And we're trying to, sort of euthanize this this whole process and make it look like medical treatment or something. Guess it's the ultimate treatment. But as I mentioned to a group today, the firing squad always works. If you can't find a vein, I guarantee you we can find a chest with four shooters that are sitting, 7 to 10 yards away, and it always works. But we don't want to do that. You know, we're off into some other kind of thing, and looking for a way to do it. Yeah, some people say in a number of years we won't even have the death penalty, but I'm not sure of that. Some states are adamant about keeping it, so we'll have to see what happens. Now, here's a story. You remember we talked about violent crime falling, or crime falling relative to the National Crime Victimization Survey. And that's the survey of victims, everybody but arson victims and homicide victims. They're not alive anymore. And so now the FBI reports have come out, and it says that violent crime fell in 2008. So really the two reports support each other, although there may be a little competition between the two groups. The FBI's crime reports comes from voluntary submission of the crime statistics on a monthly basis to a state agency, and then the state agency sends it to the FBI. And it covers probably 97 and 98% of all police departments in the United States comply with this. And they start out with a horrid story here. It says about a young black man he shot to death by another black man who's an acquaintance, continues to be the most typical homicide in the United States, according to the FBI. The FBI figures show that nearly as many black people as white were homicide victims in 2008. Think about that. Blacks are 12.4% of the population, I think. Even though 80% of Americans are white, the black and white homicide victims are almost comparable in numbers, compared with 13% who are blacks a little under that, according to census figures. To put it another way, based on census figures for white and black men of all ages, a black man was roughly six times as likely to be a homicide victim than a white man in 2008. Isn't that terrible? It really is terrible. And you hear people comment on this, and this hasn't changed a whole lot for a long time. Of the nearly 17,000 homicide victims last year, 6,782 were black, 6,838 were white, says the FBI, with men several times more likely to be victims than women. Several hundred other victims were classified as belonging to other races. Of the more than 16,000 people arrested for homicide in the U.S., 5,943 were black, 5,334 were white, with several thousand other suspects classified as belonging to other races where the race was unknown. So what happens here is you're seeing this violence among young black men. It's just, you know, it's just off the page, and it's terrible. Anyway, it's interesting to find. You can go to the Uniform Crime Rates, and you can study backwards and forwards and cut it and slice it and dice it. It's a marvelous document. It's been going on since the 1930s, and the FBI does an excellent job with this document. Are there things wrong with it, reasons why it's inaccurate? Of course there are. But I noticed that all the people that criticize this, whenever they need crime stats, some of our academics and criminologists, they go back to the FBI's UCR reports and use them. Because it's really probably the best we have. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see if we can do anything about that particular problem. Well, ladies and gentlemen, have you guessed our green tip yet? I think that the group that is way ahead of us, and they have said that they were forward-thinking people, and they have kept this a secret. Don't you think the nudist colonies are way ahead on going green? I mean, they're going nude, but in effect, they're going green. So think about that. Not only are they spending money and energy and CO2 emissions based on the purchase of clothes and all that business, but they're going to be cooler, so they're going to be running less air condition. In fact, many times they're going to be out of the house. They'll just be out in natural sunlight or on beaches or woods or something like that. And think of the reduced carbon footprint that a nudist must have. I mean, absolutely incredible. They are on the way, and I notice in Esme Floyd's book, that's not one of the 1,001 ways to save the planet. But remember where you heard it, it could catch on. It certainly could catch on. So going nude could, in fact, be one of the best ways of going green. Anyway, that's our green tip for tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to slide over now to the Pennsylvania State Police and look at one more example of both the substance and the method on how to conduct an oral history. And the gentleman we're going to be listening to tonight is a very interesting guy. His name is Lyle Zupinka. Lyle Zupinka, and he was born in 1947, and he enlisted in November 7th, 1968, and by 1980s, he was really getting promoted and moving through the ranks of the Pennsylvania State Police. This starts a little bit slow, but I think you'll enjoy it, certainly once it gets rolling. So here we are with an oral history interview. It'll take us just a second to get this set up with Major Lyle Zupinka from the Pennsylvania State Police.
It's working. I think it's working. Had a little freeze up on the computer here, at least a slow pace in terms of loading this audio. I tried it two or three times before we started. Here we go. His is a video oral history also, so you can go to the Pennsylvania State Police website and see probably a good portion of the oral histories there are actually videos also. I promise there is an oral history there.
This is the Pennsylvania State Police Oral History Project. The date is 31 May 2007. My name is Corporal Bob Mertz, PSP retired, and I'm interviewing Major Lyle H. Pinka, PSP retired. The interview is being conducted at Major Spinker's home in Canada, PA. Major Spinker, do I have the permission to videotape this interview?
Yes, you do.
Welcome, Major Spinker. Take one. Hey, Major, begin the interview. Give us a general biographical data, place of birth, family structure, civilian employment, prior military service, etc.
Well, I was born in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania in 1947. I retired when I was 58 years old. In 1974, I was married to my wife, Cynthia Lucan. We have three children, Brian, Amanda, and Carrie. With the Chartreuse Houston High School, I graduated in 1965. I then worked for the Radio Corporation of America, and in 1966, I joined the United States Marine Corps Reserve. And it was only in 1968 that I joined the Pennsylvania State Police.
Had you had any prior police service, prior to the State Police?
Our reserve unit in Steubenville, Ohio, was a military police. When I got out of the Marine Corps from my active duty, which was basically basic training, I looked at the Pennsylvania State Police. I liked what I saw. They looked sharp. They looked good in uniform. And having just did my duty in the Marine Corps, I was really impressed. And that is an organization that I looked hard at, and I prayed to God that I'd be able to become a member.
So that you answered my next question, what made you one of your had you had any friends that were in the State Police that may have prompted you to make the decision to join you?
I didn't have any friends that were actually in the Pennsylvania State Police, but I had some other friends that were police officers in the city of Washington, in the borough of Houston. I thought that would be a great, fantastic career to pursue. I looked at not only being able to help people, but I looked at the fact that would be an exciting career, an exciting job to have.
How old were you when you first joined?
I was 21 years old. I went to the academy on November 7th of 1968, and I was about 18 months out of Marine Corps boot camp. So I went to the academy in 1968. For the most part, the physical aspect of having been through Marine Corps boot camp, I found the physical aspect to be fairly simple. I was in good physical condition, and the earning aspect was a little bit tougher, but I really didn't have any problems. And then when I graduated from State Police Academy, I went and I was assigned to Troop A, Greensburg.
Do you recall who initially interviewed you?
Trooper Dick Craig from Troop B Washington. He's been retired. I know time flies by, but I bet it's been maybe 15 years or more since Dick Craig retired. He was a criminal investigator at Troop B. Well, there was a written exam, and I scored high on the written exam, and I was called to go to the academy to take my physical examination and then an oral interview. And I can remember walking into the library at the academy, and I was young and a little nervous about being interviewed. And then when I walked in there, that library looked as large as a civic arena in Pittsburgh. Years later, when I went back and actually saw how small that library is, I was actually stunned. I guess it was my nervousness. But they asked me a lot of questions, and I can remember after the oral interview, they never told me, really told me that I was accepted, but they had me sign a list of papers. And shortly thereafter, I got a notice to report to the academy for the training.
What was the background
It was not as complex as it is today. They took all my data, naturally, and they ran criminal history checks. I'd have numerous character references. They interviewed them. They went into the background of my parents and my brother to check for any criminal history. But it was nowhere near as complex as it is today.
And you recall who conducted your background?
Yeah, that was Trooper Dick Craig.
In 1916, President Theodore Roosevelt wrote, I quote him, "No political influence other than influence is there to get a single undesirable man on the court," meaning something like that. "Or to keep a man on the court because he himself unfit." Do you feel this statement helps you at all?
Oh, absolutely. There is no shortcut. There is no political pull, if you want to call it that, that can, in any way, shape, or form, where you can become a member of the Pennsylvania State Police. You have to go through the criteria that is set. You have to pass the background investigation, the polygraph. You have to score high enough on the entrance exam. There's no way, unless you follow the correct procedure, you just can't do it. There is no political influence that helps you become a member of the Pennsylvania State Police.
How much time were you given to report after you were notified?
I believe it was 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks. It wasn't that long before I had to report. In fact, that was one of the first times I'd ever crossed the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and instead of stopping at one of the rest areas on the pike to get gas, I mistakenly got off on an exit, and being a young kid, I actually got on going the wrong way. I traveled an additional probably 75 miles before I realized it, and I got off and started back east towards Harrisburg.
That's
a
pretty good. How did you feel when you were notified and hired, and what was the reaction of your wife and family? Were you married?
No, I wasn't married. I was living with my parents, and they were as enthused as I was. They were proud, and I felt very, very fortunate that I was able to be accepted. I knew short of a catastrophic injury during training that I would make it because I was determined, and I knew that I could do it, and I knew that I'd be able to become a trooper in the Pennsylvania State Police.
How big was your class?
It was approximately 100 cadets in my class.
Do you recall how many reported and how many actually graduated?
I think we lost 5 or 6 out of that 100, which was a real good percentage compared to today's standards.
Do you remember your first time you walked into the academy and running into the first day, the first night there?
Yes, I do. But in all honesty, compared to Marine Corps basic training at Parris Island, South Carolina, There was nothing that I couldn't handle.
It seems to be something that everybody remembers. I say, well,
I was fortunately, I had one leg up on a lot of the people there. There were a lot of paramilitary people, but I had already knew how to march. I had a military discipline. I knew military procedures, and then knew when to say yes, sir, and no, sir. So I had a leg up. Plus, I was in good physical condition, having, you know, within 18 months from the Marine Corps boot camp. So I had a little bit of a leg up. I knew that they were there to train me, and that the harder I trained, the better I'd have it when I became a trooper. And I accepted that, and I knew that there would be nothing that they could do that would discourage me, nothing at all.
Did they try to discourage?
Well, they don't really try to discourage you. They try to put you in pressure situations so that you can get used to working under pressure. I think any policeman, once they're actually out there working, they're constantly under stress and pressure. There's always a chance of something occurring. And I didn't realize that how bad it was until I finally retired. Every police officer, I guess you learn to accept that stress, and you don't really realize how much stress you're under until you finally retire, and it's like someone takes a load of bricks off your shoulders. So the training is good. It's designed to put you in stressful situations. It's designed to test you so that when something critical happens, when you're out on patrol, that you don't lose it, that you're able to handle the situation.
Someone who hasn't had prior military service, tell us again.
I think they would, because like I said, I was in excellent physical condition. I already knew how to march, and I knew the chain of command in a military organization, which Pennsylvania State Police is. But once they learned that, it would be no problem. But they had to accept that also. You had to accept a rugged, structured format, a rugged, structured organization, which is different. If you haven't been in the service, you can't appreciate that and realize what that's like.
What was a typical day like?
Typical day, get up at 5 a.m., go for your morning run. All day would be classes, physical training, and many times you'd run into late into the evening.
How long was the training?
For us, it was 4 months. At that time, there was an accelerated program. There was a big push to increase the number of troopers.
When did your day end? Started at 5 a.m.
Well, it varied. Sometimes it would be 9 o'clock, sometimes 8, sometimes as late as 10 or 11, all depending on what was on the schedule for the day.
Do you recall who the director of the training school was at the time?
No, I don't. Don't recall.
What kind of subjects and skills were taught, and how often were you tested?
Well, you were taught, you know, the physical skills of boxing and wrestling. Prior to those days include rules of criminal procedures. They actually had typing classes, spelling classes, writing classes, block printing, which is essential for any type of reports that we do. Firearms training. Shotguns, and at that time, our revolvers.
Did you have to learn to ride a horse?
Every cadet learns to ride a horse. I think they still do today. Most people, it wasn't a real problem. You had some farm boys there who rode horses all their life, and they really enjoyed it. So I didn't have a problem, but you did have some people from the inner city that had never actually even been around a horse. But they learned, and they did well. Sure. And I can remember learning to ride the horses, which was a confidence builder. I can remember all the days we spent cleaning the stalls and grooming the horses. In fact, I can also remember when we had a state police rodeo. And I think it was 1974 that they discontinued that. But I can remember, even before I was in a state police, I can remember going to South Park in Pittsburgh, in Allegheny County, just outside of Pittsburgh, and being impressed by the troopers on horseback, by their shooting skills, and the motorcycle riding. And I was sorry to see that end in 1974.
Why did it end? Do you have any idea?
I think it a number of problems. I think number one, it became to be a very expensive proposition. So expenses was definitely a concern. And at that time, you know, late 70s, there were a lot more problems with crime, civil unrest. And the detail that they used on the radio detail, that took a lot of troopers off the road. We really needed those to do police work. And I think when they looked at the overall picture, it was something that they just could not have any longer. But I thought it was a great public relations event. I never had the opportunity to be part of that. And I kind of wish that maybe if I would have joined the state police earlier, been born earlier and everything, and that was something I would have loved to have been involved in the rodeo. Taylor, Trooper Taylor. And he's from the eastern part of Pennsylvania, and he retired probably 10 years before I did.
What was that?
Oh, he was a trooper when he retired.
Did any particular instructor impress
you? At the time, it was Corporal Bill Reagan, who later retired as a major in the state police. And he was one of our physical education instructors. And he used to drive us and push us hard. And we didn't like it at the time, but years later you look back on it, and that was one of the best things we did. I was always a poor swimmer. And I can remember, I don't remember exactly what I did wrong, but we were at the pool at the time, and you maybe do about 10 or 15 laps. And I almost drowned because I was a poor swimmer. But I had to did those laps, and he stood there and watched me do those laps. And this is horrible. But later on, come to appreciate, you know, what they put you through, and it really helped me in the future.
I would say, knowing Major Reagan, he was it didn't matter as much to him how far he could swim or how many chin-ups you could do, that you tried and so you couldn't go. That's what impressed him.
Bill Reagan was also in the Marine Corps, and he liked discipline. He liked pushing you, and he wanted you to give 100%. I was very fortunate only to have him train me at the academy, but years later, once I graduated, I was on the road, and I progressed through the ranks. I've had numerous opportunities, or had numerous opportunities to actually work with. A strict guy, a hard charger, good hard worker.
I think it's you're talking about progressing to the rank.
Yes, part of that, I patrolled out of Coupe Greensburg, Somerset, Chiskey Valley, and Greensburg headquarters, and then I was transferred to BCI in Harrisburg for drug enforcement. We did a statewide investigation. I stayed there for about a year. Then I transferred to the Western Drug Task Force, which later became the Regional 5 Strike Force, doing undercover investigations. And then I had a notion I should study for the promotion exam. And in 1978, I was promoted to corporal. And that time I cut my hair and I shaved, but I'd been working undercover for years, and I went to Troop B, Washington, and I was patrol unit supervisor at Troop B, Washington.
And it's awfully impressive how fast people promoted, which means that you did a lot of hard work. Corporal in 78, started in 80, 2 years later, lieutenant. That's a lot of studying.
A lot of studying. I was determined, once I had made corporal, I had studied, and the number of hours that I had studied the books that had to be studied, I was fortunate, and I ranked third in the state for corporal. And my thought process was that I spent that much time studying that as soon as I was eligible, I should study for the next exam, because why forget all the stuff that I had learned, how hard I studied, and I figured, well, while I was on a roll and I was really studying hard, then I might as well continue that. And when the sergeant exam came along, I ranked fifth in the state for sergeant. When the lieutenant exam came along, I ranked seventh for lieutenant. 10. At that time, they were giving competitive testing for the rank of captain, which included role-playing and box exercises and what have you. And during the very first test, I was ranked in the very top group for promotion.
I'm going to ask you, but I'm not going to ask you to recite it, but there's a number of follow-up.
Yes, I do.
And I would imagine you
could recite it. I could recite it.
If you want to. Okay, your career with the Pennsylvania State Police pretty much what we touched on. How about some of the major highlights of your career? Major investigations, incidents, if you call, of sizable proportions.
Well, that's one of the things that I miss most about being with the Pennsylvania State Police. I like those large-scale incidents where you may have hundreds of troopers involved and local and federal police officers, because I always felt that during those major incidents, that's when law enforcement would step forward and they show you the best that they had to offer. I think my first major incident would have been in 1989 when they had the riots at Camp Hill, just outside of Harrisburg. I know I was called by my area commander, and at that time I was the commanding officer of Troop B, Washington. I was called by Major Terry Clements, who was my area commander, who was at Camp Hill, and he told me that he wanted me to bring at least 100, if not more, troopers. And as soon as I could, I would report to the command post at Camp Hill. Well, we gathered up as many troopers as we could. We came out close to 100, and we traveled the Pennsylvania Turnpike. We got there late in the afternoon. They fed us, and at that time, they had just put down the riot. And I can remember going in and talking to the deputy commissioner, who was Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Walt, and he told me that I would be in charge of the night detail at one of the compounds inside the institute.
Well, I think people get the idea of the method in terms of oral history. It's a fascinating thing to be involved in. There are all kinds of oral history associations and projects across the United States going back probably a half century or so. And the Library of Congress stores a lot of this stuff, at least in text, and I think some of their audio is available to the public also. So that's oral history. We didn't get to the part about his 9/11 response to the plane crash in Pennsylvania. That was very interesting. Some of the things he said about what he saw, I might play just a little clip of that next week when we have another topic. But very very interesting the oral history process. And get involved in it if you're not now. It's a good way to make a contribution to not only your own community but history in general. Well, Audrey, what do you think? I see you giving us the sign, so it's time to go, folks, and we want to see you again, as Vera Lynn will tell us. Good night.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know where.